Chapter 156. After a lapse, the sea at Ebdan flowed through a whole year. Through a whole year, the winds and clouds had come and gone. The ceaseless work of time had been performed in storm and sunshine. Through a whole year, the tides of human chance and change had set in their allotted courses. Through a whole year, the famous house of Dombey and Son had fought a fight for life against cross accidents, doubtful rumors, unsuccessful ventures, unpropitious times, and most of all, against the infatuation of its head, who would not contract its enterprises by a hair's breadth, and would not listen to a word of warning that the ship he strained so hard against the storm was weak and could not bear it. The year was out, and the great house was down. One summer afternoon, a year, wanting some odd days, after the marriage in the city church, there was a buzz and whisper upon change of a great failure. A certain cold, proud man, well known there, was not there, nor was he represented there. Next day it was noised abroad that Dombey and Son had stopped, and next night there was a list of bankrupts published, headed by that name. The world was very busy now, in sooth, and had a deal to say. It was an innocently credulous and a much ill-used world. It was a world in which there was no other sort of bankruptcy whatever. There were no conspicuous people in it, trading far and wide on rotten banks of religion, patriotism, virtue, honor. There was no amount worth mentioning of mere paper in circulation, on which anybody lived pretty handsomely, promising to pay great sums of goodness with no effects. There were no shortcomings anywhere, in anything but money. The world was very angry indeed, and the people especially, who, in a worse world, might have been supposed to be apt traders themselves in shows and pretenses, were observed to be mightily indignant. Here was a new inducement to dissipation, presented to that sport of circumstances, Mr. Perch the messenger. It was apparently the fate of Mr. Perch to be always waking up and finding himself famous. He had but yesterday, as one might say, subsided into private life from the celebrity of the elopement and the events that followed it, and now he was made a more important man than ever by the bankruptcy. Gliding from his bracket in the outer office where he now sat, watching the strange faces of accountants and others, who quickly superseded nearly all the old clerks, Mr. Perch had but to show himself in the court outside, or, at farthest, in the bar of the King's Arms, to be asked a multitude of questions, almost certain to include that interesting question, what would he take to drink? Then would Mr. Perch descant upon the hours of acute uneasiness he and Mrs. Perch had suffered out at Ball's Pond, when they first suspected things was going wrong. Apostrophe then would Mr. Perch relate to gaping listeners, in a low voice, as if the corpse of the deceased house were lying unburied in the next room, how Mrs. Perch had first come to surmise that things was going wrong, by hearing him, Perch, moaning in his sleep, 12 and 9 pence in the pound, 12 and 9 pence in the pound. Apostrophe, apostrophe, which act of somnambulism he supposed to have originated in the impression made upon him by the change in Mr. Dombey's face. Then would he inform them how he had once said, "Might I make so bold as ask, sir, are you unhappy in your mind?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, and how Mr. Dombey had replied, "My faithful Perch, but no, it cannot be." Apostrophe, apostrophe, and with that it struck his hand upon his forehead, and said, "Leave me, Perch." Apostrophe, apostrophe, then, in short, would Mr. Perch, a victim to his position, tell all manner of lies, affecting himself to tears by those that were of a moving nature, and really believing that the inventions of yesterday had, on repetition, a sort of truth about them today. Mr. Perch always closed these conferences by meekly remarking that, of course, whatever his suspicions might have been, as if he had ever had any, it wasn't for him to betray his trust, was it? Which sentiment, there never being any creditors present, was received as doing great honor to his feelings. Thus, he generally brought away a soothed conscience, and left an agreeable impression behind him, when he returned to his bracket. Again to sit watching the strange faces of the accountants and others, making so free with the great mysteries, the books, or now and then, to go on tiptoe into Mr. Dombey's empty room, and stir the fire, or to take an airing at the door, and have a little more doleful chat with any straggler whom he knew, or to propitiate, with various small attentions, the head accountant, from whom Mr. Perch had expectations of a messengership in a fire office, when the affairs of the house should be wound up. To Major Bagstock, the bankruptcy was quite a calamity. The Major was not a sympathetic character, his attention being wholly concentrated on J.B., nor was he a man subject to lively emotions, except in the physical regards of gasping and choking. But he had so paraded his friend Dombey at the club, had so flourished him at the heads of the members in general, and so put them down by continual assertion of his riches, that the club, being but human, was delighted to retort upon the Major, by asking him, with a show of great concern, whether this tremendous smash had been at all expected, and how his friend Dombey bore it. To such questions, the Major, waxing very purple, would reply that it was a bad world, sir, altogether, that Joey knew a thing or two, but had been done, sir, done like an infant, that if you had foretold this, sir, to J. Bagstock, when he went abroad with Dombey, and was chasing that vagabond up and down France, J. Bagstock would have pooh-poohed you, sir, by the Lord. That Joe had been deceived, sir, taken in, hoodwinked, blindfolded, but was brought awake again and staring, insomuch, sir, that if Joe's father were to rise up from the grave tomorrow, he wouldn't trust the old blade with a penny piece, but would tell him that his son Josh was too old a soldier to be done again, sir, that he was a suspicious, crabbed, cranky, used up, J.B. infidel, sir, and that if it were consistent with the dignity of a rough and tough old major, of the old school, who had the honor of being personally known to, and commended by, their late Royal Highnesses the Dukes of Kent and York, to retire to a tub and live in it, by gad, sir, he'd have a tub in Pall Mall tomorrow, to show his contempt for mankind. Of all this, and many variations of the same tune, the Major would deliver himself with, so many apoplectic symptoms, such rollings of his head, and such violent growls of ill usage and resentment, that the younger members of the club surmised he had invested money in his friend Dombey's house, and lost it, though the older soldiers and deeper dogs, who knew Joe better, wouldn't hear of such a thing. The unfortunate native, expressing no opinion, suffered dreadfully, not merely in his moral feelings, which were regularly fusillated by the Major every hour in the day, and riddled through and through, but in his sensitiveness to bodily knocks and bumps, which was kept continually on the stretch. For 6 entire weeks after the bankruptcy, this miserable foreigner lived in a rainy season of bootjacks and brushes. Mrs. Chick had 3 ideas upon the subject of the terrible reverse. The first was that she could not understand it. The second, that her brother had not made an effort. The third, that if she had been invited to dinner on the day of that first party, it never would have happened, and that she had said so, at the time. Nobody's opinion stayed the misfortune, lightened it, or made it heavier. It was understood that the affairs of the house were to be wound up as they best could be, that Mr. Dombey freely resigned everything he had, and asked for no favor from anyone, that any resumption of the business was out of the question, as he would listen to no friendly negotiation having that compromise in view, that he had relinquished every post of trust or distinction he had held, as a man respected among merchants, that he was dying, according to some, that he was going melancholy mad, according to others, that he was a broken man, according to all. The clerks dispersed, after holding a little dinner of condolence among themselves, which was enlivened by comic singing, and went off admirably. Some took places abroad, and some engaged in other houses at home. Some looked up relations in the country, for whom they suddenly remembered they had a particular affection, and some advertised for employment in the newspapers. Mr. Perch alone remained of all the late establishment, sitting on his bracket looking at the accountants, or starting off it, to propitiate the head accountant, who was to get him into the fire office. The counting house soon got to be dirty and neglected. The principal slipper and dog's collar seller, at the corner of the court, would have doubted the propriety of throwing up his forefinger to the brim of his hat, any more, if Mr. Dombey had appeared there now, and the ticket porter, with his hands under his white apron, moralized good sound morality about ambition, which, he observed, was not, in his opinion, made to rhyme to perdition, for nothing. Mr. Morphin, the hazel-eyed bachelor, with the hair and whiskers sprinkled with gray, was perhaps the only person within the atmosphere of the house its head, of course, excepted who was heartily and deeply affected by the disaster that had befallen it. He had treated Mr. Dombey with due respect and deference through many years, but he had never disguised his natural character, or meanly truckled to him, or pampered his master passion for the advancement of his own purposes. He had, therefore, no self-disrespect to avenge, no long-tightened springs to release with a quick recoil. He worked early and late to unravel whatever was complicated or difficult in the records of the transactions of the house, was always in attendance, to explain whatever required explanation, sat in his old room sometimes very late at night, studying points by his mastery of which he could spare Mr. Dombey the pain of being personally referred to, and then would go home to Islington, and calm his mind, by producing the most dismal and forlorn sounds out of his violoncello, before going to bed. He was solacing himself with this melodious grumbler one evening, and, having been much dispirited by the proceedings of the day, was scraping consolation out of its deepest notes, when his landlady, who was fortunately deaf, and had no other consciousness of these performances than a sensation of something rumbling in her bones, announced a lady. In mourning, apostrophe she said. The violoncello stopped immediately, and the performer, laying it on the sofa with great tenderness and care, made a sign that the lady was to come in. He followed directly, and met Harriet Carker on the stair. Alone. He said, and John here this morning. Is there anything the matter, my dear? But no, he added, your face tells quite another story. I am afraid it is a selfish revelation that you see there, then, she answered. It is a very pleasant one, said he, and, if selfish, a novelty too, worth seeing in you. But I don't believe that. He had placed a chair for her by this time, and sat down opposite, the violoncello lying snugly on the sofa between them. You will not be surprised at my coming alone, or at John's not having told you I was coming, said Harriet, and you will believe that, when I tell you why I have come. May I do so now? You can do nothing better. You were not busy? He pointed to the violoncello lying on the sofa, and said I have been, all day. Here's my witness. I have been confiding all my cares to it. I wish I had none, but my own to tell. Is the house at an end? Said Harriet, earnestly. Completely at an end. Will it never be resumed? Never. The bright expression of her face was not overshadowed as her lips silently repeated the word. He seemed to observe this with some little involuntary surprise, and said again, never. You remember what I told you. It has been, all along, impossible to convince him, impossible to reason with him, sometimes, impossible even to approach him. The worst has happened, and the house has fallen, never to be built up anymore. And Mr. Dombey, is he personally ruined? Apostrophe apostrophe ruined. Apostrophe will he have no private fortune left? Nothing. Apostrophe a certain eagerness in her voice, and something that was almost joyful in her look, seemed to surprise him more and more, to disappoint him too, and jar discordantly against his own emotions. He drummed with the fingers of one hand on the table, looking wistfully at her, and shaking his head, said, after a pause, "The extent of Mr. Dombey's resources is not accurately within my knowledge, but though they are doubtless very large, his obligations are enormous. He is a gentleman of high honor and integrity. Any man in his position could, and many a man in his position would, have saved himself, by making terms which would have very slightly, almost insensibly, increased the losses of those who had had dealings with him, and left him a remnant to live upon. But he is resolved on payment to the last farthing of his means. His own words are, that they will clear, or nearly clear, the house, and that no one can lose much. Ah, Miss Harriet, it would do us no harm, to remember oftener than we do, that vices are sometimes only virtues carried to excess. His pride shows well in this." Apostrophe, she heard him with little, or no change in her expression, and with a divided attention, that showed her to be busy with something, in her own mind. When he was silent, she asked him hurriedly, "Have you seen him lately?" Apostrophe apostrophe, no one sees him. When this crisis of his affairs renders it necessary for him to come out of his house, he comes out for the occasion, and again goes home, and shuts himself up, and will see no one. He has written me a letter, acknowledging our past connection in higher terms than it deserved, and parting from me. I am delicate of obtruding myself upon him now, never having had much intercourse with him in better times, but I have tried to do so. I have written, gone there, entreated. Quite in vain. Apostrophe, he watched her, as in the hope that she would testify some greater concern than she had yet shown, and spoke gravely and feelingly, as if to impress her the more, but there was no change in her. "Well, well, Miss Harriet, apostrophe," he said, with a disappointed air, "this is not to the purpose. You have not come here to hear this. Some other and pleasanter theme is in your mind. Let it be in mine too, and we shall talk upon more equal terms. Come." Apostrophe, "No, it is the same theme," apostrophe returned Harriet, with frank and quick surprise. "Is it not likely that it should be? Is it not natural that John and I should have been thinking and speaking very much of late of these great changes? Mr. Dombey, whom he served so many years, you know, upon what terms reduced, as you describe, and we quite rich. Apostrophe apostrophe, good, true face, as that face of hers was, and pleasant as it had been to him, Mr. Morphin, the hazel-eyed bachelor, since the first time he had ever looked upon it, it pleased him less at that moment, lighted with a ray of exultation, than it had ever pleased him before. I need not remind you, apostrophe," said Harriet, casting down her eyes upon her black dress, "through what means our circumstances changed. You have not forgotten that our brother James, upon that dreadful day, left no will, no relations but ourselves." Apostrophe, the face was pleasanter to him now, though it was pale and melancholy, than it had been a moment since. He seemed to breathe more cheerily. "You know, apostrophe," she said, "our history, the history of both my brothers, in connection with the unfortunate unhappy gentleman, of Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.